welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
In early April, a group of students taught by Rachel Barr at the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship told their stories. Their themes range from learning to drive to grappling with religion. In the first half of the show, we'll hear from Zane Kareem, Ben Foley, Maisie Fielder, and Rowan Morse. We begin today's show with Zane Kareem's story about how sometimes advice is good and sometimes it's not.
Zane is a 13-year-old extrovert who spends her free time dancing, watching Fuller House on Netflix, and scrolling through Instagram. She is working towards becoming a high school teacher. Zane.
So when I was 12 years old, I'd lived most of my life in Bloomington, Indiana. But right now, I was living in a town in Canada called Maple Ridge, which is, of course, the most Canadian name of a town ever. And I was going to a school called MRSS. Anyone that ever seen it before would say it looked like it was straight out of the movies. And that's because a couple movies actually were shot there. There, in the hallways, the walls were lined with lockers everywhere you went, and it was really big. It had 3 gyms, a track, a football field, lacrosse field, and 2 buildings. So that meant sometimes you had to walk through the rain just to get to your next class and maybe even get exhausted a bit trying to get there. So this was about the time I started getting involved in some conflict in school, because in my gym class, which was an all-girls gym class, there were a group of girls that were kind of like the Plastics from Mean Girls, if you've ever seen that movie before. And the girl that was there, Regina George of it, would bully everyone, and people thought that she was sweet, and I just didn't see it. And a lot of the people that were the outcasts didn't really see it either. So there was a girl in our gym class, and her name was Gloria. And when she wore short sleeves, you could see that she had marks on her arms because she was harming herself. She had ADHD, and she also had a lisp, and people would make fun of her for it. And I just thought that was a really low thing to do. So when I was in class, in gym class, we were playing dodgeball, and it was just Regina and I and Gloria all left in the game. And I heard Regina bossing around Gloria, and I was so fed up. You know, it's gym class, not in good mood. So it was just kind of like word vomit at that point. I was like telling her, I said, you should pick on someone your own size. And she said, I wasn't talking to you. I told her I was talking to you. And that's when I said it. I told her, if you don't stop, it's not going to be pretty. And she just walked away. And class was over, and I just went somewhere where no one would have to confront me about what happened. And even though all of this happened, I met my best friend, Valentina. And she was a very sarcastic person. She had a dark sense of humor. So I was enjoying school just a bit more because I was having a lot more laughs than I'd had that whole year. And that's when I found out that Regina had been telling people I had threatened to beat her up. And people were believing it. People were advocating for her and saying they heard me say it when there was no one else there when it had happened. So it just gave me so much anxiety when I was after gym class. I heard people in the hallway. I was in the changing room, so they didn't know I could hear them. They were saying, what's she going to do? Is she going to fight you or something? And they thought that I was a coward because I had challenged her and I had gone back on it, but that wasn't what had happened. So instead of them thinking that I was using my words, they thought that I was just giving all bark and no bite. After that, my mom noticed how gloomy I was finding school because I would come home and she would ask me how my day was, and I would always tell her it was bad. And I was actually considering asking her to transfer schools because I just didn't want to be there anymore at that point. I had a really bad reputation after that, and I didn't like that because that wasn't who I was. My mom told me that our house in Bloomington was, the lady that had rented it out had moved out, so now if we moved back, I could just go live there, and then I could just go to the academy, and it would be fine. It took me a long time to make up my decision because That was the kind of thing you take a while to think about. And she told me that I had until the end of the week to make up my mind. So I just didn't know what to do. I asked some of my friends and my teachers, and they were telling me, you're going to a good school. There are kids at other schools that are like on a waiting list to get here. And then you're in both of the only honors classes in your grade. So why would you want to give that up and go to another school? We weren't academically the best, but we were the physically the biggest school in our town. And we were the best school in our town, but I knew that it wasn't going to be the same as if I was in Bloomington. And I was a really indecisive person, so at this point, I was like, I would go to a store and get something, go back home and be like, maybe you should have gotten a different color. That's how indecisive I was. So my biggest pet peeve was people who would ask for your advice, but then they would like go back on it and just do something else. So I was worried that I was gonna make the wrong decision and decide to go, and I would regret it, or I would stay and always think, what would happen if I had left? I had like physically settled into Canada. I found it familiar. I knew where I was going when I was walking around town and stuff. So it was all I'd known for like 3 years at that point. But in the end, I decided that I wanted to move to Bloomington. What I've learned from this is that it doesn't really matter if you have the biggest school or if your friends give you advice on what to do. You should worry about what's the best for yourself, because you shouldn't let people who don't have to deal with the consequences make your decisions for you. Thank you.
Next up, we have Ben Foley with his story, Speed Bumps. Ben is a chess player, geography enthusiast, and author. He is currently working on a soon-to-be-published novel. Ben.
Cars have always been a fascination of mine. Something innate, like it was coded deep in my genes from the very start. At an early age, I would walk to the edge of the railroad tracks, maybe a few minutes close to home, watching all the cars zip by, those two narrow parallel lines, pointing out the make and model of each vehicle that I spotted. There were no Teslas back then, but there were a lot of Toyotas and Hondas. I liked all things transportation, but especially cars. So recently, at my age 16, I realized it was time for me to drive myself. And so the first step for me to do that with my disability was to go register for the statewide government program at Vocational Rehabilitation to see if they could pay for the adaptive equipment that I could use to drive a car. So there was an ephemeral wait, after which I sat down with a curly older woman who would guide me to the very end of my mission. And then she really told me, she admonished me about all the hardship or the hard complexities that were present during this like 2.5 year long process. And so I was a little taken aback, but I felt really, really determined and encouraged. So one chilly day in November, I went to Indianapolis to have this driving evaluation, the first actual evaluation to see what adaptive equipment I could actually use to drive in the future. So we tried many things. We tried first, I'll list two. We tried a metal disc that I could steer with my feet on the ground. Of the floor of the car, and that ended up not working. So what we did is we tried a joystick, like in a video game, and that ultimately ended up working. And so we tried a few things. We experimented with the position of the joystick, and that all was fine. However, at the very end of the meeting, I was greeted with a truly catch-22 situation, one that really shoved the entire day into the trash. Because the driving trainer said, now you've got to wait till you're 18 to complete your nighttime drive, or to complete your hours, your practice hours of driving. And I was really taken aback. Now, you might be wondering why this actually is. Well, as the law of Indiana states, you must complete your 10 hours of nighttime driving as well as 40 hours of daytime driving in order to actually get your license and get out on the road. So and then so with this adaptive equipment, you're only supposed to have a specialized driving trainer do it with you, not like any ordinary person over 21 or 25. So so really, and they couldn't do it because it was too much of a commitment to stay up that late at night to train me on the hours. So with that all said, I was really frustrated. I wanted to and angry about this. So I wanted to really show the state of Indiana that I could really drive before I was 18. So night fell, or it was later in the evening, and I booted up my computer in my room. I ate an early dinner, and I opened up a Google Drive document, and I started making a candid petition, one that outlined all my requests, all my worries, and all my what I wanted to do, all my fear, my anxieties about this, and my eagerness, my anticipation, and. And then I typed my keys with haste, with an intrinsic meticulousness, like spilling droplets of frustration onto the page, monitoring my vocabulary, restraining my emotion, preserving my ultimate persuasiveness, all that I could muster, and ultimately I finished the petition, and I started pushing it to the social media sites, and I was excited to see how many signatures I could get next morning. And so next morning, I got a lot of signatures, and over a course of 2 or 3 weeks, I got over 150, close to 200 signatures. And so that was a very exciting thing for me. And so just recently, about last month, I'd say, I got a call, or my family got a call from vocational rehabilitation again, and I was thinking to myself, well, why would that be? Because if there was no good news associated with this, they really wouldn't be calling me. So I had this effervescent excitement within me that I would actually be able to get to drive, or good news, or if I could get to drive the way or the time I wanted to. So, so we went to voc rehab one day, scheduled an appointment, and there was a short wait again, followed by an entrance into the supervisor. So the older curly haired woman and her supervisor. We walked into one of her rooms in the building, and we talked for a little bit. We talked for about 15 minutes about all my requests and my wants and my needs to drive before I was 18, and then we would see what would happen from there. So, 10 to 15 minutes into the meeting, I could look back on everything. The petition, my contacts, the first evaluation, my precocious love for cars at like 3, and I could really have an unparalleled appreciation for all those things, because because they really it was a good thing, because if I had not done those things, then I wouldn't be in my position right now. I wouldn't be in that office building. right then, and because the outcome was, the realization was that, or the answer from voc rehab was that I could drive before I was 18. The trainer said that I could, the nighttime driving hours were covered by someone who lived in Evansville, so that was a very great relief for me. So now, looking back at those, it took about a year, that long process, I realized that the times may have been difficult, watching as my peers, my friends walked away or drove away in their cars home, you know, and imagining waiting 2, possibly more years for a license. But now, now that I have really went through this process, I've been patient, I've been composed, and I've actually realized the outcome, what's going to happen. I can drive before I'm 18. All that work that I've put into it drastically pays off. Thank you.
Next up is Maisie Fielder. The story of her narrative is there anywhere Maisie Fielder won't throw a tantrum, a European extravaganza? She was born in Manhattan and raised in the Ohio River. She is currently living in Bloomington, Indiana. Maisie has had numerous places to throw tantrums in. Her latest happened in Milan, Italy. Maisie.
Okay. Hi. Okay. He's really tall, so I'm So over the summer, me and my mom went on a 3-week extravaganza, as like she liked to put it. It really wasn't that extravagant. But we went to Europe. When I think of Europe, I think of like the Lizzie McGuire movie where she like goes to Europe, she like meets cute boys, she like becomes a rock star. Like that's what people think about, like, right? But for me, it wasn't what happened. I was a repulsive 14-year-old with a mullet at the time, traveling alone with her mom. The only cute boys I met was when I was sitting down, minding my own business, like eating McDonald's from egg rolls, when a group of boys like came up to me and they started like growling at me and like barking like dog noises and talking to me in German. Oh my gosh. The first red flag that like Europe wasn't going to be like the same for me as it was for Lizzie McGuire was in Paris. So when we got off the train station, we like walked out and whatever, we weren't in Paris anymore. We were in Little India. There wasn't like the smell of like baguettes or whatever. It was incense. And instead of, you know, cute boutiques, it was sari shops. Paris was not what I expected. So we stayed in hostels the whole time, which is kind of like a cheap alternative to hotels. So it's like small like dorm room when you like sleep around 4 to 6 other people, and like it's like you're supposed to meet people, but when you're like a self-conscious, insecure like 14-year-old with a mullet, like you don't really want to like meet new people. But at the time, my friend was also having her own Lizzie McGuire extravaganza, and so except she was 2 blocks from the Louvre, staying in like this really nice Airbnb while I was in my bunk crying because the lady next to me was snoring so loud. But the main atrocity happened in Milan. So we get off, we like go to the train station and like we get off and whatever. And like it's pouring down rain, it's thunderstorming. And so we like get a taxi. And the taxi, like, is driving us around for, like, 10 minutes. And she drops us off in, like, some suburban neighborhood. So we're like, okay, that's cool. And so she drives off. She, like, blasts off before we can say anything. And so we're just, like, looking around. We don't see, like, anywhere that could be, like, a hostel. Because they're usually, like, kind of, like, in the downtown area. But we're in, like, a middle-aged, like, mom place. And so basically, we like wander around. It's like pouring down rain. We don't have any data because I had used it all, Snapchatting everything in Vienna. And so basically, we like stumble around a little bit and we like stumble across like some like shady place that we discover is our hostel. So we go in. I'm sobbing. And at the counter is Danny DeVito. It's not actually Danny DeVito, don't get too excited, but it's like the Italian equivalent of him. And so I'm sobbing. My mom knows I can't sleep with like some like stranger that's snoring. And so she's like, Maisie, leave the room. I got this. And so I leave the room and we get our own rooms. Like she seduces with her like mama magic. And so we go in and I'm throw myself down on the cot and I'm crying. I'm like watching Game of Thrones and I have like, I'm searching up plane tickets to go back to Indiana. Anyway, so my mom's kind of like laughing about this. She's like, ha ha ha, like Indiana, that's so funny, Maisie. And she realizes like how serious I am. And so she like zooms off, she's gone. And she goes to get some like nice pizza and some like Italian wine or whatever. And so she comes back. She doesn't have any leftovers for me. And that sounds really selfish, but it's fine. Like, I'm okay. And so I'm like, Mom, what the heck? And so she says that I could have gone with her, but so she does this, like, the day after that and the day after that. And, like, I'm just rioting at this point. Like, I'm not going out. Like, I finished Game of Thrones, so there's nothing for me to do. So I just, like, sit there, and I'm like, I just cry the whole time. And so She gives me a choice later, but it's not really a choice. Like, she says it's a choice, but I'm have to do whatever she says. It's like a mom thing, but... So she says, Maisie, you can either starve to death or you can go on to Montpellier. And I chose Montpellier, and I cried the whole time. I cried the whole time in Europe, and I felt so bad. Like, I kept doing it anyway, but I spent the whole time in Europe crying and being annoying and, like, annoyed at being annoying. And it was like this whole cycle of crying and being annoying. And when I got back to the States, I like sat myself down. I was like, Maisie, you need to calm down. You can't do this anymore. And I like to think I changed. Like, I sat myself down. I was like, there's no true like Lizzie McGuire movie. Like, that's not a thing. And there's no like perfect place. And I'm glad of it now, even if I wasn't then. So that's it. We're done.
Now we have Rowan Morse. Rowan is a 15-year-old who, after school, does track and field, teaches robotics, and does BPA. Rowan's title is Breaking the Bubble.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, so back in around fourth and fifth grade, I used to be a really shy person. I would have really only talked to two people, and those were my friends, Mason and Xander. And I guess those were like really my real conversations where I would actually, you know, tell them a little about myself and talk with them. So a little further on, more in sixth grade, I started breaking out of what I called my bubble of solitude and started talking to people and started joining extracurricular activities. One of those was Boy Scouts. And so when I started joining Boy Scouts, I started making more friends and I started doing more campouts, and it was pretty fun. And the whole big thing about Boy Scouts is summer camp. And that's sort of like the big thing that everybody talks about and that everybody is looking forward to. And you start planning like 6 months ahead. And I started getting a little worried about this, even though everybody said it would be fine. It would be a really fun experience. And it's no slow moments. It's just all action, action, action. Because about 4 months before that, my friend at my first camp out jumped off a picnic table into a crevice and broke his arm. So we thought that was really rowdy with only about 10 kids on the camp out. There were going to be about 300 at summer camp. So I was just sort of wanting everything to go okay. And I was a little worried that it wouldn't. It'd just be a little too chaotic for me. So once we sort of started getting ready in like the last week of planning, we were all excited. We were divvying up into cars, and it was soon enough where we had to go out and actually arrive at camp. So after driving along this really bumpy road for that seemed like an hour, we get to this the entrance of the camp, and I expected to see this grand arch that said Mommy Boy Scout Camp Reservation or something like that, and it was just going to be like this fantastic moment as you enter, and it's just going to be like, oh. So as we were entering, that is not what I saw. I saw two little mounds of rocks about like 3 feet high with two by fours stuck in them that just said Mommy Boy Scout Camp Reservation. So I was pretty disappointed in this. I was just thinking that this is not a good start to camp. It's not what I expected, and this is not going to go well. So the first thing I started doing as we entered was thinking about what I was going to do. And other than the merit badge work that I had to do to get like awards and stupid stuff like that, it was stay inside my tent the whole week. So I would stay inside my tent, not talk to anybody, and just be alone, probably sleep the whole time. And eventually my friends actually got me to go out. So we started going boating, and I did a little kayaking before camp with my dad. We would occasionally go out on the water and do some boating. But this was, I guess, my first like real time doing it with friends and like actually knowing what to do instead of just sort of flopping around like a fish. So we started going out, and people were crashing boats together because it was apparently fun. I always thought that was just like a room for disaster, and you never do that because you're going to flip. So eventually you just hear, "All boats come into the station." So we all had to bring our boats back. And so we were all getting ready to go, and we decided to make this plan where we had a race, and whoever got there first got a treat from the shop bought by the loser of the race. So there were like about three or four of us there, and we were all just getting ready. It's 3, 2, go, and the race was on. So all you could hear was constant paddling, and it was just a bunch of slapping against the water. And all I hear just slightly is, "Get him!" So, and then I see this this boat driven by, let's say, just friend one, let's call him. So just this boat just flies out in front of me, and I just sort of put my paddle in the water and did something that slightly resembled a power drift, and I was like, yes, I feel like Speed Racer! And I was really happy about this, and it was like, just give me the treat now, I won! And then the person who screamed, "Get him," let's just call him friend two, gets hit by friend one and flips over. So there we are. There's about like four or five kids. One of them is already out of the boat, and then the four of us are still in them. And so as we were trying to help friend two get back on his boat so he can paddle back safely, he pulls friend one in the water with him. So then there are five of us, three in a boat, two still in water now. And so we decide, let's not help them and make them make them carry the boats on their back as they swim about 100 feet back to shore. This actually worked out surprisingly, but I was just sitting back in my kayak laughing at their misery, and like we were all just cracking up just about how they, if they let the boats fall into the abyss of the lake, they would get in a lot of trouble and probably get kicked out. So they were there trying to swim back with the boats on their backs, and eventually we got back. There were a couple of us spotting them, making sure they didn't drown or anything like that. So once we actually got back, we signed out, took our little, I think what we called them, buddy tags. You take them out of like the little hook with the shape of the boat that there is. And we were just sort of laughing as we were drying ourselves off and putting our socks and our shirts back on. And we were just laughing at the whole experience. And as we walked back to camp, we were just sort of, I guess we were still laughing, and we were talking about how stupid we were sometimes and like sort of the things that we'd done. And now that I sort of think back on it, I realize that without sort of breaking out of my bubble and without joining like Boy Scouts and other things, I would have not made these moments that I would cherish forever. Thank you.
You have been listening to Student Stories on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to a series of stories told in early April by a group of students taught by Rachel Barr at the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship. Their themes range from learning to drive to grappling with religion. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from Cormac O'Sullivan, Paige Nevitt, Freddie Mendez, and Rose Nicholson. We'll be right back. We now return to the show with Cormac O'Sullivan and his story, My Not-So-Terrible Secret.
Cormac was born in Ireland and moved to America in the 7th grade. He spends most of his time playing video games or sleeping. Cormac.
Okay, so this story takes place back in Ireland in a small town I lived in called Carrick-on-Shore. The part I lived in, Faheen, was out in the countryside. So it was all green. Fields went on for miles. There was animals everywhere. And the small place barely could be considered a town. 10 houses, a church, and recycle bins. Congratulations. So me and my family went to the church that was in this town every Sunday. Prayers were said, priest would talk about stuff, and then we'd take communion. I don't remember what happened. And then we'd go home. It was very boring. I didn't enjoy it. I could have been doing anything else at the time and enjoyed it more. So when I was around 9, I began questioning things that were more related to the Merle who's in religion, like ghost stories, things that seem unexplainable. I was a bit of a science kid, so I like facts. And I didn't start believing in religion anymore. And I felt like I would get in trouble for this, like small community built around a church. I didn't think I was in a good situation. So I decided to keep it a secret, so I couldn't talk to anyone about this at all. And I still had to go to church, because then I'd have to tell my secret in order to get out of going to church. And it was extremely awkward, because both my grandparents worked at the church. My grandfather rang the bell, and my grandmother, before she died, used to go into the church and make sure everything was clean before the next Mass. And it turned from church into an awkward workout session. You had to sit down, stand up, walk around, step over lazy people's legs that didn't bother to move. And a memory game, having to remember when to say what you needed to say at the right time. It wasn't a fun memory game. And I always felt awkward taking communion, because they said that they blessed a piece of bread, because that's how the story went. It was like a small circle. It didn't taste like bread at all. Whenever it was in my mouth, I was thinking, why is this thing in my mouth, and what is it made of? At the time, I settled on it being made of paper. Yes, I tasted paper to confirm my thoughts. And that, it was just awkward all around. So I kept the secret for more than a year, doing my confirmation so no one would suspect me for anything. And I gave in to the pressure eventually and decided to tell my dad when we were driving somewhere that I didn't believe in what they believed in. He had a reaction that really surprised me and made me rethink everything I was feeling beforehand. And that he had no reaction. He really didn't mind what I believed in. And he was glad that I could trust him and be able to tell him. My mother had the same reaction, didn't really mind, and she has a thought process that I try to have in every situation, that if you're not hurting someone, you're not really doing anything wrong, so you shouldn't be told to stop if it isn't really affecting anyone negatively. My sister's too young to care, and my grandfather that worked at the church, he didn't really mind either. We still hung out, watched TV whenever we could, after school, late at night, whatever. And the situation really, I learned something from this experience, and that if you have something on your mind, no matter how bad you think it is or how bad it is, there's always someone you can tell. I was fortunate I had my family by my side, but I realized that it wasn't just them. I had my aunts, had my uncles, had my cousins, had my friends. They were all there for me, and I was just too clouded by stress to actually see that. And I also learned that you should respect each other in what you believe in. I didn't believe in their religion, but I still went to church with them, on special occasions such as weddings, funerals, Christmas, Easter, whatever was important to them, because I respected them and they were my family, and I wanted to share things with them. So I learned to respect others for what they believe, and I expect that I should be respected for what I believe as well.
Next up is Paige Niven. The story of her narrative is My Friend Fluffy. Paige was born in Bloomington, Indiana on November 1st, 2001. She grew up writing stories and drawing and had aspirations to become a scientist when she grew up. Paige.
Okay, so when I was 11 years old, I wanted to be a scientist. I would take my notebook out into the woods with a little pencil, and I would write and draw and write down things I found, like misshapen mushrooms or animal tracks. And later, I would go and I would type in the descriptions into Google and find out what it was. So the story begins when I was 11 years old, out in the woods, with my notebook and my pencil, and I was having fun writing stuff down and just exploring the woods behind my house. So I walked a little farther than usual that day, and I finally came across this odd clearing, like way out in the woods. And as I looked out, there seemed to be this little structure out maybe like 3/4 of the way across the clearing. And it was like this little blue and white house with a nice little, a quaint little porch and windows, and it was painted nicely, and it seemed so trim and untouched in the wild clearing. And it seemed like there hadn't been people there in a long time, because the grass was tall and the wildflowers were everywhere. And I was very intrigued by the structure. So I walked out, I began to walk out, like, my aspirations of a scientist faded from my mind, and it was replaced by curiosity as I walked out into the clearing. I was about halfway across the clearing, getting closer to the cabin structure, when I saw movement out of the corner of my eye to my left. I turned my head, and I felt all the curiosity drain out of my body, replaced with fear. For a second I thought that someone's German Shepherd had gotten loose. But as I watched it, it didn't seem like a dog to me. It was like more of a miniaturized wolf. And it took a while for the word coyote to pop up in my brain as my mind struggled to figure out what it was. My dad had told me that they were only a little bigger than foxes, but this one, I was sure that this one could have been 12 foxes. So I'm standing here in the clearing, like looking at this coyote who's sniffing the ground, and I'm just like rooted in place with fear, because I'm 11 years old, I'm a small kid, and like this thing could probably like weigh twice as much as I did when I was 11. And so I was standing there weighing my options, and I could go back the way I'd been, but if there were more coyotes, then it meant that if they decided to gang up on me, then I would have nowhere to go. So I decided to walk out towards the cabin. And I start speed walking towards the cabin like an old lady with a stroller, which looked kind of ridiculous to any human, but I knew if I started running, that I would probably like more easily catch the attention of the coyote, and it might start chasing me, and I did not want that. So as I'm running towards the coyote, I feel like a sharp pain through my entire body, and I'm knocked backwards. And when I look up, it turned out I had run straight into one of the posts on the porch while I had been looking back at the coyote. So I get up, and I'm too scared to be embarrassed for myself. So I jump up onto the porch, and I start rattling the doorknob as hard as I can. I think I managed to break the lock entirely because the door swings open really fast with a squeal. I cram myself inside, and I slam the door shut and lean against the door like a horror movie character who escapes just in time from the malignant zombie. So I'm leaning against the cabin with my eyes, the door of the cabin with my eyes closed, and then my eyes snap open when I realize I don't know what's inside the cabin. I look around, there isn't much. It's just an old dusty bed frame an old charcoal grill that still smells vaguely of hot dogs, and a pile of sleeping bags that were sure to be crawling with spiders. And I get up and I peer through the window of the grimy window of the cabin, out towards the coyote. It's still sniffing the ground, and as I watch it, it gets up and it trots out of view, back into the forest. And I was a little nervous now, because now I didn't know where it was, and it could be, if I was going to go home, and it could be anywhere. So I'm pacing the cabin right now, my mind just running over the incident. And finally, my 11-year-old self gets bored. I'm still inside this cabin, by myself, in the middle of the woods, and I haven't had lunch yet, and I'm really, really hungry. So I get tired of it, so I decide, you know what, I'm just going to go home. So I pick up my notebook, my pencil. I decide to use my pencil to defend myself in case it tries to attack me again, or it tries to attack me. And I'm like, okay, and I leave the cabin, and as the door swings shut behind me, I quickly remember my fear. The coyote resembled I start thinking about the coyote, and to sort of comfort myself, I think about, it didn't really look all that mean to me. It looked more like one of my own dogs. I thought about keeping it in my backyard and feeding it Cheez-Its. And I make my way across the clearing again without incident. As I'm regaining my confidence, I enter the woods, and then I see it standing right in my path on the deer trail that I used to get there. It's just standing there on the trail. It's sniffing, it looks up, and it makes eye contact with me. And I am petrified. So I stand there for a few seconds, staring at it. Then I just decide, you know, I don't care. So I get up and I walk right around the coyote, and I'm just walking, picking my way back home, sort of shuffling sideways because I want to keep my eye on it. And it turns around and it watches me walk away for a while. Then it starts following me. So I'm making my way back. I'm making my way back home, sort of shuffling my way sideways while looking at the coyote and making sure that doesn't get too close. But I almost trip a few times, and I stop looking at it for a while. And when I turn around, I realize that it's gotten closer to me, and that it sort of creeps forward a little bit closer every time I stop looking at it. So, and that scares me a little, but I start looking at it and thinking, maybe it wants to be friends with me. Maybe it wants to play with me. So I finally get to the end of the woods, and I come out of the woods, and there's a big hill, and my house is at the top of the hill. And I'm over here, and I start making my way up the street towards my house. And the coyote stands right at the tree line and watches me walk up, but doesn't go out on the street. And as I watch it, I realize, and as I walk away, I think it looks a little sad to me, because maybe it wanted to play with me. But then later I realize that it only looked sad because it had lost a possible meal. So I go inside and start excitedly telling my parents and my brother the story of my new friend. And I had decided to name it Fluffy when I was walking back. And my parents were, of course, horrified that I had been stalked all the way through the woods by a coyote on the way home. And it goes without saying that I wasn't allowed in the woods by myself anymore. And they sort of dashed my hopes and dreams of being friends with the coyote. And they explained to me that its intention was not to play with me. So this experience taught me to sort of bend down, to get my head out of the clouds a little bit more, and to look at people and realize that what I want them to be is not usually how they really are.
Now we have Freddie Mendez. Freddie is a 15-year-old boy who was born in California and moved to Indiana at a young age. He has moved around all his life, seeing new things and meeting new people. Freddie's title is Same Story, Different House.
So
So all my life, we would move around going from place to place, never really having a home. We could live somewhere for a couple of months or even years, and it would always be me, my little brother, my sister, and my mom. And there would always be a new guy in the mix, and that would usually be the reason we ended up moving so often. My mom would want to move in together with them, and then things would never work out. All my life, we probably moved a total of 7 times, like starting at a young age. And every time we moved, it would usually be like a pick up and go type situation. And 2 of the times we moved, we'd gotten dogs and either had to leave them with that guy or give them away. And one of the times we had a dog named Tito, and she was an older dog. She was a good dog, but my mom would bring her to different social events, to the park and other things. And the only reason the guy didn't like him is because he thought our mom paid more attention to the dog than him. And so when we moved, we gave her away to a family, and it sucked, but it was the best thing for her. I think the worst time we moved was going back to Bloomington. My mom had met a guy, and when we moved, it was our birthday, so we had to spend it with him and his family. And the only thing me and Andromeda wanted was to spend it with our family. And it just sucked because every year we would spend it with our mom and new people. And then it was another birthday pass that we had spent with just people we didn't know. And after a couple months, we got a new dog, Sydney. And we got her from the shelter, and she was older. And she was good, though. And the only reason she was in there is because her old family couldn't take care of her. So they had paid for her adoption fee, so any family that wanted her could just take her. And so we decided to adopt her. The last couple of months of us living with the new guy, moving back to Bloomington, was probably the worst time. All my mom did with him was fight a lot, and he had ended up moving into the basement and built a wall up so we could use the washer and dryer to wash our clothes, but he set up a door that no one could get in unless you had a key, and I had a key. And I would go downstairs and work out, and he'd try to talk to me and just rant about his day and how much he hated our mom, and I just wouldn't listen to him. And when we were moving out, it felt like a weight was lifted off my shoulders. We're finally getting out of that place, and it was like, because it was just toxic just living there. And when we moved, it felt like a whole new chapter in my life, and it made me realize that I wanted to have a better lifestyle, not just for me but my whole family, and I wanted to better myself so I could better my family as a whole. Thank you.
Next up is Rose Nicholson with her story, Bravery Isn't That Easy. Rose is 13 years old and aspires to be an exotic veterinarian. And yes, she knows how hard it is to get into vet school, so you might not want to bother asking. Rose.
So my brother is kind of annoying, like most younger siblings generally are. But despite this fact, I genuinely love him. Most of the time. One of those most of the times was when my brother was little, he had this wonderful habit of punching me in the arm or doing something like that, and then turning around with these giant crocodile tears streaming down his face and this little stuttery, shaky voice pointing to me, turning around to my mother and going, "She hit me!" And my mother believed him! So that was not always the best, but she started to catch on now a little bit to his terrible antics. But there are some times when he is genuinely a good sibling, like that one Christmas where he had forgotten that he had already gotten me a Christmas gift. So he insisted to tell my parents that we had to go to the store because she's such a good sister and I can't forget to give her a Christmas gift. So as siblings, there are many events, like any siblings, that have brought us closer together. One of these events started on a sunny July afternoon when my brother and my dad had just gotten back from a go-kart race. My dad began to say that his back was kind of hurting a little bit, but he brushed it off thinking that, you know, he probably just sprained something at the go-kart race and it wasn't that serious. But later that night, my mom started to see that it was pretty serious. So we headed to the ER, and there they took a few pictures, but there wasn't a radiologist on call, so nobody could really look and tell us specifically if there was anything wrong. So they said generally it looked like it was gonna be okay, probably just like a muscle got pulled or something like that. Just kind of take lots of rest, and me and my brother were both so relieved. We're like, oh, good, it's nothing tragic. So that night, we headed back home, and then in the middle of the night, I was woken up by my mom telling me, you have to get dressed. Things have taken a turn for the worst. Your dad can't keep food down. The pain's getting worse. So I put on my clothes, and my mother carried my brother out to the car, and we got back into our bright red truck and headed to the ER. Once again, so it's about 11 p.m. when we get to the ER, and we don't get a room until about 4 a.m. That's a lot of waiting in those painfully white halls. So finally, we get a room, and then we meet who I like to personally call Dr. No Filter. This doctor didn't really know or understand maybe what topics you shouldn't talk around kids. Some of his favorites actually included the details of surgery and how to cut somebody open, and the fact that if you give this one certain kind of medication in a large enough dose that my father was on at the time, it can actually stop your heart. I think my heart stopped a little bit right then. So, and that morning, some friends come to pick us up because my mom has to stay at the hospital with my dad and make sure everything's going okay and everything like that. So we go to our friend's house, and it's really tough. It's just me and my younger brother, who at this time is 6, and I was 8 or 9. And it was a really stressful situation. My mom tried to come home the nights that she could, but she couldn't always come home because there was stuff to do at the hospital. So every night, like clockwork, we would call her before bed. And she would, of course, keep this bright and cheery attitude for Nathan, my younger brother. And some nights when she would come home, it would be so late that my brother was already to bed. And she would come and tell me what was happening. And there was really no improvement for that first week. And I tried to keep Nathan's mind off of it as much as possible. We would play outside in the woods and build forts. And we played with our friends' kids. And we played board games. And it was the summer that the Summer Olympics was on. So we watched the Olympics with popcorn. And we tried to make it as fun as possible. But it just was a really difficult situation. So then the beginning of the second week rolls around. And my brother gets the stomach flu. So still trying to keep a light and somewhat happy mood in this really, like, troublesome situation, we play inside. We play board games, and we try all these different things. And at the same time, my dad really isn't improving at all. If anything, he's getting worse and worse by the day. So my mom decides that Bloomington isn't doing anything. We're going up to Indy. As soon as they get there, they realize that he has a blood clot in one of the arteries leading to his intestine. And the medication that they've actually been giving him has been making it worse and actually helping that blood clot to grow. And this was essentially cutting off any blood circulation to a certain section of his intestine. So that almost had to be surgically removed, but thankfully we caught it in time that it didn't. So after that week, when he got transferred to Indy, everything started to improve. So halfway through that second week, we went up and we were going to stay with my mom because they thought he was improving enough that we would be out by the end of that second week. So me and my mom comes and gets us, and we drive up to Indy, and we walk through those painfully white halls and that hospital smell. And you know, everybody knows what that smell is. It's terribly clean. So we get into his room, and I see my dad lying there, and I break down. This past week and a half, I've had to be so strong for my younger brother. And seeing my dad lying there, this man that I look to for so much, that he's that strength, that dad can do it, you know what I mean? And he's just laying there, sort of pale, hooked up to who knows how many tubes and wires. And I look over, and standing next to me is my little brother with this huge smile plastered on his face. And I will always remember this moment because I realized in that moment, this event was different to us. To him, it was this event where it was still terrible and scary, but he had this big sister that was there for him and we played fun games. And being strong for him is something I will never, ever regret. So we stay in the hospital and we spend our days with our dad doing fun little things. And as much as you can, we brought a ton of board games. And by the end of that second week, we were discharged and we headed home. And I still to this day will never regret that I somehow made this terrible, horrible situation better for my brother. So 5 years later, everything is better. There have been no complications. There have been other tough times, but, you know, we've gotten past those. And my brother has finally stopped doing the whole, but you hit me thing. And he's still terrible and amazing. And if there's one thing that I've learned from this experience is that if you have the opportunity to be brave for somebody else, take it. You will never, ever regret it. And bravery sometimes isn't even that choice. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a series of stories told in early April by a group of students taught by Rachel Barr at the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship. Stories this week came from Zane Karim, Ben Foley, Maisie Fielder, Rowan Morse, Cormac O'Sullivan, Paige Nevitt, Freddie Mendez, and Rose Nicholson. Their themes ranged from learning to drive, to gallivanting in Europe, to grappling with religion. The commonality was that each storyteller learned something new.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.